In 2013, Nicole Cundiff and Michelle Bachelet lost their mother too soon.
She loved traveling. She took mission trips. She loved dancing to live music. She was learning to ride a motorcycle, taking horseback riding lessons. She was just a woman who had a lot of love to give and a lot more life to live.
Colleen Drury passed away that year after a long battle with ovarian cancer. Now her four daughters are honoring her legacy with a foundation aimed at educating women about preventing ovarian cancer. And two of them, Nicole and Michelle, have taken that call to heart. Both recently had surgery to remove their fallopian tubes, a preventative measure that they hope more women will consider. I sat down with both of them recently to talk more about that decision and the broader movement of women using things like genetic testing and preventative surgeries to hedge their risk of getting cancers like this. They told me when their mother started experiencing some discomfort in her stomach, she sought treatment from several doctors, but none of them seemed alarmed by her symptoms.
Her symptoms became worse and worse and worse. And at that point, I was 7 months pregnant. And our mom, who was very thin, started to look almost as pregnant as I was. And you could just see in her eyes that something wasn't right. And so she kept knocking down doctors' doors, looking for answers. And it wasn't until one day when she couldn't get out of bed to go watch Arizona State play football that her friends really started to notice that something wasn't right. And one of our good friends here in Phoenix is an emergency room doctor, and he called and said, you know what, it's Sunday, it's my day off, why don't we walk through the CAT scan and we'll just do a bunch of major tests to rule anything big out and let's see why you're not feeling normally. And at that point, she was diagnosed with stage 3C ovarian cancer.
Wow, so that's almost just a helping hand. Like that sounds like it was harder than it should have been to find that diagnosis, right?
It was harder than it should have been. And without this friend in our lives, I don't know how much longer it would have taken for her to get answers. So we recognize that we were extremely lucky because no one was taking her seriously. No one was listening. And it could have been another few months before they got answers. And by that point, she probably wouldn't have had any time left.
So your mother passed away in 2013, right? And since then, you have started this foundation in her name. And it sounds like you're focusing a lot on this idea of prevention and awareness. What are some of the challenges that obviously popped up in your mother's case in terms of recognizing ovarian cancer to begin with for women?
Gosh, there's so many. So the first was that the signs and symptoms generally for women are there. So we need to educate women to know these signs and symptoms, but also equally as important, doctors need to recognize these signs and symptoms. The biggest challenge with ovarian cancer is that there's no early detection screening tool. So a lot of women think when they go to the gynecologist and they get a pap smear that they're looking for ovarian cancer, and they're not. A pap smear only tests for cervical cancer. Mm-hmm. And so without an early detection screening tool, many women are diagnosed in late stages when it's almost too late.
Right. There's no mammogram for this.
There's no mammogram.
Okay. So without that, both of you, because of your mother, you said, are at higher risk for ovarian cancer. So you've decided to do something pretty extreme, like get an elective surgery in prevention. Tell us about what it is that you did and why scientifically that was a good way to go for you.
What has become apparent through research over the past few years, they're believing that ovarian cancer is actually originating from the fallopian tubes. So what happens is they think that it comes out of the fallopian tubes and somewhat sprinkles onto the ovaries, which is why it's so difficult to diagnose early. It's because it starts in this little tiny area, and by the time that it's released onto the ovaries, it's actually released into the entire abdominal cavity. Mm-hmm. And so before you know it, it's like a sandblast all over the entire inside of your stomach and the organs and whatnot, which is clearly why it goes from 0 to 60 and becomes so deadly. You know, to now know that you can take out your fallopian tubes with very little risk, it's a really minor procedure. And, you know, that alone doesn't impact, you know, your ability to create hormones through your ovaries. And if you want to, you could continue to keep your uterus. But, you know, taking out that connector piece could decrease your ovarian cancer risk significantly. So, you know, for me, in thinking about it, that's a no-brainer. It's a no-risk, all-reward type procedure. It was something I knew I was going to do. But I have to say, in general, the decision was extremely emotional for me, mostly because our mom, after our little sister was born, she had had an emergency hysterectomy. And back then, they saw no reason to take the fallopian tubes. They had left her ovaries for, you know, the obvious reasons for the hormones, but they kept her fallopian tubes. And you know, through many discussions with the gynecological oncologists that we have developed relationships with over, you know, the past 11 years, and through our own, it just, had she had those removed, she'd very, very likely have never gotten ovarian cancer and she'd still be here today. So it's an opportunity she didn't get. Mm-hmm. And I actually feel very blessed that research has advanced enough that it's something that we can do, and it's something that we can share the word about to others.
Nicole, why did you decide to do this as well?
For me, it was really important to take these measures because I have three young children, and after going through what we went through with losing our mom at a young age and watching other women who are in their 30s and 40s fight for their lives and want so desperately to be around for their children, I just felt like the best opportunity that I have to decrease my risk of this terrible disease that we know so much about was to go through the surgery. And through our foundation, Colleen's Dream, we're constantly educating women about the signs and symptoms, knowing their family history, to seek genetic counseling and testing, and to know what their options were. And it was time for us to basically walk the walk.
It must have been a little scary, though, going into this and knowing that it might not make any difference at all, but you thought that it was something that could help. What do you tell women when they're contemplating this?
You know, it's difficult because every woman's journey is different, and you really have to take women as they are. We have educated a lot of women on their options and watched them go through genetic testing, and it's fascinating to see how everyone responds differently. We recently had a friend who was diagnosed, and she went through a full hysterectomy, had her ovaries removed, fallopian tubes removed, and for her it was a no-brainer. And we've seen other people who've been diagnosed with different genetic mutations who are almost paralyzed by the information and don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important to seek the proper genetic counseling so you can know your options, and you need to also be ready to seek therapy if you need it, because, you know, these are life-changing decisions. When you remove your fallopian tubes, you're compromising your fertility. And, you know, there's a lot to think about, a lot of different factors at play. And so it's very personal, it's very complicated, and it's not a one-size-fits-all.
Mm-hmm. So this is becoming more common, right, to do this kind of thing, these sort of elective preventative surgeries. We've obviously heard stories about women getting double mastectomies because they're at high risk for breast cancer. Now there are people who are getting hysterectomies to prevent this sort of cancer, or uterine cancer, or cervical cancer, something like that. What do you think about the rise of this and the knowledge that women have that they didn't have before that can be a blessing but also maybe a burden?
The best way to look at it is that the information is, it's powerful, and it can also be very liberating. It's taking your future into your own hands. For me, you know, to not know or to not be able to take the bull by the horns, for lack of a better analogy, and to do something was much scarier than doing it. So I think that if, you know, women really could dive in more and be able to really control their destiny, they can feel more empowered by what their future might look like rather than, you know, turning a blind eye to it.
Do you think your mom would be happy that this is something you've both done?
Absolutely. She encouraged us to do this. One of her biggest fears was that we would go through something like she went through.
All right. Nicole Cundiff and Michelle Bachelet, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Deep research continues and is progressing on whether it makes sense for people to have preventive surgeries and under what circumstances. Dr. Susan Domchak is involved in that area, specifically related to breast cancer, as the director of the Basser Center for BRCA at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's with us now. Dr. Domchak, what sort of dramatic changes are you seeing in the field of genetic research, and how is that affecting whether people choose to have these preventive surgeries?
The field of genetics has been rapidly expanding, and we're learning more and more about it all the time, including how to use genetic information to help reduce risk and decide on specific prophylactic procedures. But it's worth stating that BRCA1 and BRCA2, the most commonly known cancer susceptibility genes, were identified in 1994 and 1995. So this is still relatively new, and we know a lot about those genes, but we know a lot less about other genes that we've discovered and really started to study over the last several years. So this is a burgeoning field. It's very important that people know their family history, and if they're appropriate candidates for genetic testing, get that done so that they can make an informed decision.
When it comes to this sort of thing, when it comes to what a patient is considering what to do, where are the ethics involved for a doctor? Ultimately, it's the individual decision, but should doctors provide specific advice on this? And when it comes to this idea, the concept of even doing that, is there an ethical line that may or may not be crossed?
Sure. What you're getting at is critically important, which is the concept of the risk and benefit of any particular procedure. And it's clearly a physician or other healthcare professional's role to review that with an individual. What is the risk of a preventive surgery and what is the benefit? In order to do that, you have to really understand what the risk of cancer is. So for instance, for an average American woman whose lifetime risk of breast cancer is 13%, but whose risk of dying from breast cancer is actually fairly low, having a preventative mastectomy is very unlikely to benefit her in the long run. We can all sort of agree on that, right? For an individual who has a lifetime risk of 70%, that is a reasonable option. What you're asking and is important is, what's the line? Is there a specific threshold at which a mastectomy should never be performed? I think that's very difficult, but recognizing that mastectomy comes with downsides and they need to be clearly explained to women as they're trying to make these decisions.
I know this varies from individual to individual, but is there then a right answer? Or is it that just has to be your individual circumstance, knowing that there are risks from surgery, but you may also possibly not actually get the cancer?
It's also important to realize that having a preventative mastectomy does not completely eliminate development of cancer. So even if you have surgery, there's a small chance, but there is a risk of developing cancer anyway. This gets to a larger issue of how we explain risk in medicine, and I would argue that we don't always do a very good job of this. Having individuals understand what their risk is of having things happen to them is really important when they try to make decisions. And so there are a lot of people that are trying to get at better ways to explain risk, whether that's be at different types of graphs or charts or what that is, because especially for breast cancer, there is a lot of anxiety, understandably, associated with it. There's a lot of awareness of it, but stage one breast cancers, the vast majority of women survive those cancers. And so when we're talking about surgery, which is, you know, removing healthy body parts with complications, because every surgery can have complications, we really need to keep that in mind and be able to better explain what the actual risk of cancer is and what the actual risk of the procedures are.
I want to dig in a little bit more as it relates to the effects on mind and body and the concerns sort of before and after. And I'm thinking more mentally too, the fear that something could happen and then the fear of not taking the step. How much does that weigh into, frankly, what people have to deal with before and after? Because sometimes fear can dominate, fear of the unknown.
Sure. One of the phrases that we use to describe exactly what you just said is anticipatory decisional regret, which is a mouthful, but it's basically, if you decide on surgery, you worry about the consequences of surgery, and if you decide to not do surgery, you worry that you might develop cancer, right? You're kind of looking ahead at an outcome that might occur. That's difficult. So what we try to really do is present sort of the actual risks to individuals. I'll give a very specific example. When women are diagnosed with breast cancer, and even if a woman has no family history and does not have a genetic susceptibility, a lot of women do consider removal of the other breast. And part of that is the thought that that will improve their survival related to the cancer they already have. But it doesn't. All that does is reduce the risk of a second cancer in the other breast. And so we have to be really clear to communicate the differences, because in the early studies that were done, women thought that by being aggressive, they were more actively treating the cancer they already had, but they weren't. That it really was completely separated out from that. So when people are dealing with decisions that they need to make, quickly when they've just been diagnosed with breast cancer, it's particularly important to differentiate these things. When people are deciding on preventative surgery, which is, if you will, semi-elective, it doesn't have to be at a particular time, we have more time to really review those sorts of pros and cons. And it may not surprise you that not everybody makes the same decisions. There are different times when people make these decisions, and they can do it in a different way. So it's a very, very individualized.
Dr. Susan Domchak is in the field of breast cancer research at the University of Pennsylvania.